On the Empire Podcast this week, we talk to Star-Lord himself, a.k.a. Burt Macklin, FBI, a.k.a. at Pratt Pratt Pratt, a.k.a. Chris Pratt, about Guardians of the Galaxy, while we also shout pod wankers at not one, not two, not three, but all four members of the Inbetweeners as they drop by to talk about their upcoming sequel. All that plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the only movie podcast that's recorded on National Orgasm Day. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast in association with Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com. and use the offer code EMPIRE25. That offer code again, EMPIRE25. This week, once again, we have just two colleagues with me. First up is our art house guru, a man who's never been to Comic-Con because he insists on cosplaying as a tree of wooden clogs. It's Phil Dissemblian. Hello.
Hello. I get my higher branches stuck in the roof of Hall H.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you related to Groot in any way?
I am clogs. I am clogs.
Clogs? Because I'm Dutch. Okay. And you just heard him there. It's our film facts fiend, a man who would go to Comic-Con and cosplay as IMDb because he knows so goddamn much. There's so many film facts rolling around that big head of his. It's Ali Plum.
Yeah, you should see my trivia section, ladies.
Hello. Would you cosplay? Would you ever cosplay?
Yes, I would, yeah.
What would you cosplay as?
I would cosplay as... I'd go as the dude. I would definitely go as the dude. I don't have to add that much to my general look, so I'd do that. But I don't know whether that's nerdy enough, because if it's Comic-Con, it's going to really be super nerdy. The best Comic-Con cosplay I saw when I was there last year were the characters, the white and red characters from a computer game called Journey. If anybody knows what I'm talking about, they'll have their faces lit up with joy. White and red cloaked beings that just float and chirp and are generally amazing. To them, I say congratulations for being amazing. There are also quite a few game cosplays, just generally in Comic-Con. It's not just comics or films. It's anything you can think of.
It's a wide-ranging spectrum. It's great. I've just come back, and I saw a lot of great costumes this year. I think one of the most bizarre ones I saw was a guy who went around dressed as John Coffey from The Green Mile. Really, really good. Looked fantastic. And he had a toy mouse in his hand that he kept holding out to people as Mr. Jingles. It was very bizarre. But he looked fantastic. But there were loads of really great ones. There was a Cyclops who had basically a cut-price Cyclops who had used a pair of old yellow Beats headphones that he'd, for his visor. And he'd stuck them in the back of his head and hoped no one had noticed. He'd rubbed out the Beats logo. But I recognised those Beats headphones because they're cool and down with the kids.
Cyclops? Oh, Cyclops.
Cyclops.
I was thinking not about Cyclops. Harryhausen.
No,
I was just like, are they known for wearing headphones?
Oh, art house Phil.
Oh, Phil.
What would you cosplay as? Seriously, not the tree of wooden clogs, clearly, because it's expensive. What would you cosplay as?
What about Truck Nazi from Raiders? I don't suppose you can go as a Nazi, though, can you?
Let me just double check with society.
I'm getting a maybe on that one.
Prince Harry
I'm getting, but I'm not in the royal family of any country.
You sound like you could be in the royal family. You sound like you could be in the Romanian royal family.
I don't think they've got one anymore, Chris, to be honest. Do they?
Fredonia.
I'll find out. Fredonia's got one. That's a good point. I don't know. Something from a Wes Anderson film, perhaps.
That'd be amazing.
You come as Badger.
Something, one of like Max Fisher's guises. That'd be cool.
Obviously, I'd go as fully naked and scarred and eyeless Dr. William Weir from Event Horizon. I think that wouldn't surprise anybody.
Would you actually gouge your eyes out?
I'm wearing it right now.
yes,
I am. I am.
Would you think about going as Peter Lorre from M? No, not M.
You're bad example. Shocker, Bill.
Bad example. So you that was the first one that came to my mind. What about the Maltese Falcon?
That's a Nazi and a paedophile.
How about just coming as Hitler? Just come as Hitler.
You can see why I've not been to Comic-Con before. I would love to go to Comic-Con, but I wouldn't go as a Nazi or a paedophile.
No. Well, now we all know, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't know.
Right, okay, enough.
Oh, by the way.
Enough small talk.
What
enough
banter.
Preamble. Great banter, guys.
So, I was going to say, by the way, there is a great... I watched Zach Braff's new film last night. There is a great cosplay Comic-Con moment in it. Really entertaining.
Right, it's time for your questions now. You've been sending them in via Twitter, via email all week. This is one from @DavidStreet76. In lieu of the weather, what are your favourite summer movies and /or films that feature excessive heat? Excessive heat?
Excessive heat. The sequel to Heat everybody wanted, with even more Robert De Niro. 12 Angry Men, I know, is going to get a lot of people nodding in agreement. And anybody disagrees with me, well, I'll kill you. I wouldn't actually kill you. So that, and also Do the Right Thing, which really
captures a sweaty New York summer.
Yeah, really does the heat thing right.
It's good. I'm going to focus on the second part of the question rather than the favorite summer movies. I don't know if I have a favorite summer movie. Obviously, Summer Rental. I'm going to focus on the heat question. Wake and Fright. Phenomenal. It's set in the Australian outback. It came out a few months ago. It re-released in cinemas now on DVD and Blu-ray. It's fantastic. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. It's a dark nightmare set in the Australian outback, and I think captures heat on film, the sense of heat that they really did shoot in just baking temperatures with flies. Visible on screen. Actually, Ted Kotcheff, the director, told me that he had flies specially shipped in and was basically just flinging them at
bullshit.
The actors. No, there were flies already there.
But you can't ship flies on. They live for like 3 days.
To be fair, the bullshit helped.
Flinging the flies in. To make sure.
Another shipment of flies have arrived and they're all dead again.
He put his hand to the fly bag, pulled out a handful of flies, and just chucked at them.
Yeah. Mm. Where are the flies? They're refusing to come out of their trailer.
Yeah.
Fly my pretties.
That's amazing. You interviewed him about that film. I cannot overstate what an impact that film had on me when I watched it this year for the first time, having never heard of it, because it was one of those lost movies, wasn't it, that kind of disappeared and was rediscovered, but you're right, captures this sweltering, sticky kind of thing. Strange things happen in film when it's hot.
Yeah.
But you can sense that. You can sense it almost on the celluloid sort of dripping, the sweat and the clamminess. Mm. There's a great one of those, Joseph Lucy's The Go-Between. The adaptation of, I'm going to say J.R. Hartley, but it pretty much wasn't J.R. Hartley because he wrote Fly Fishing.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't J.R. Hartley.
Apology, L.P. Hartley, perhaps, with Judy Christie and a young kid. It's about adult world through the eyes of a child, one of those great films about childhood. And it's got that same, it's set in, I think, Norfolk. If you liked Atonement is very much sort of inspired and influenced by that film. Atonement's another one that's got that kind of, you can hear the kind of the flies buzzing and the heat reflecting on the water. You can't hear that, actually, that'd be weird, but you know what I mean.
Barton Fink is hot in of itself in summertime, but then things get extra hot when everything goes up in flames. Also, Dog Day Afternoon, I think, is one of those hot, sweaty ones.
Yeah, very clammy film. Mm.
Very clammy film.
Cool Hand Luke's another one of those sweaty ones.
Yeah, that's right, chain gang stuff.
Should be called.
I tell you one that I don't like, which is, I guess, traditionally cited in this because it justifies Marilyn's ultimate manoeuvre. But The 7 Year Itch, I always did not like as a movie, though everything's in it, I should like. It should add up to something I really enjoy, but I find it very uncomfortable, and not because of the heat. I just don't. It doesn't gel as an enjoyable film for me. But also, Streetcar Named Desire has the passion. Mm. We haven't actually films really that have really included the hot sexiness.
Well, it is National Orgasm Day.
Tears. Don't, Chris. It's a Dennis Quaid film with Ellen Barkin, The Big Easy. Yeah. That's a hot film, isn't it?
Very sultry.
We're not mentioning westerns. You think where it's always hot?
Yeah.
Because it's always hot. And so you sort of take it for granted. I kind of prefer westerns when it gets cold and snowy, like The Searchers, for instance. Yeah. When they go plowing through the snow, you're like, there's a novelty to that.
Leone's westerns always had a real sense of cloying heat.
True.
Which I really liked.
The beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West, of course.
And I guess you're looking at, you know, films, you know, Wake and Fright, obviously, I think, is the apotheosis of this. But, you do look at the Mad Max films. I think they have a real sense of heat. And there's a great, great British sci-fi film from the early 60s called The Day the Earth Caught Fire.
That sounds hot.
Which is fantastic, yeah. It's basically about the world being burned up, which obviously brings to mind also Nick Cage's
of
masterpiece.
Of course, who could forget Knowing. Two stars by me.
You were incorrect, sir. I stand with Roger Ebert in this one. The late great Roger Ebert. I love that film.
Fine. Bring Roger Ebert to the review party, why don't you?
Yeah, I will.
Have you heard the sequel?
Which is?
Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Hey!
Well, originally they were going to call it Knowing Me, Knowing Two, but I thought that would be silly.
When you said you were bringing energy to this podcast, I didn't know how much energy you were going to bring.
Almost too much energy.
Too much energy.
Mainly it's just cock pops.
It is.
I had something interesting to say.
Okay, be a first, but go on.
No, I've forgotten it.
Okay, great.
All right, we'll keep going.
No, Eddie, give me a second.
Here's a question from the mysterious James G. Oh, by the way, David Street, we didn't answer the first part of your question. Maybe we'll get around to that some other point, because I think summer movies are a different thing. They're fun and frolicky and joyful. And we talked about movies that are dark and depressing. So we'll talk about
something else. Did we? Oh, yeah, we did. You're right.
Wake and Fright, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so James G via email, he doesn't give his full name, says, which scene in a film terrified you as a child? Not necessarily a scary film, but something that really shook you up. Mine would be, this is James G's, mine would be the scene in Superman 3 where the lady, that is Robert Vaughn's sister, where the lady gets dragged into the computer and turned into a cyborg. Good answer, James G. Absolutely, that scene destroyed me as a kid as well. I remember watching it even on, it was used as a clip on shows like Going Live or Saturday Superstore or whatever it was at that time. And they showed that clip as a promo for Superman 3. And even the clip scared me. Scared to live with that. So basically the clip is towards the end of Superman 3. Robert Vaughn, the big bad guy, and his evil sister, played by Anne Ross, have retreated to a mountain hideout and have lured Superman to them. And they've built a supercomputer to try and take on Superman. And the supercomputer at some point during the climax becomes sentient and self-aware and lures, drags Anne Ross's character into its guts and basically turns into a cyborg with glowing red eyes. And she walks in a very jerky, stilted, possessed fashion, and it just scared the living bejesus out of me. So that stayed with me for a long time. Mm. A long time.
Mm. Can imagine. Cool IT if that ever happens to you.
Indeed. Well, now when you watch Superman 3, it's scary for all sorts of other reasons. That scene, less so these days.
That bit with Richard Pryor flies out of a window,
skiing off the top of a building and landing on the sidewalk.
Is that the one that was shot mostly in Milton Keynes?
Yes.
No, that was the fourth one.
That's the fourth.
Oh,
yeah,
that's the fourth. That's the fourth.
Three is the first one that's fully directed by Richard Lester.
Gotcha.
Who took over Superman.
And how does it compare with two, quality wise?
It doesn't really. It has a great opening though. Fantastic opening. This great slapstick sequence with Bob Todd from Benny Hill. Do you remember Bob Todd? No. Benny Hill sidekick. It sets off this sort of cartwheel, this sort of Rube Goldberg kind of chain reaction of slapstick that just unfolds in front of Clark Kent's eyes. It's really, really funny, actually. So it has its high points. Superman 3. It has its points.
My answer to this question isn't actually from a film. I've mentioned before how I've loved / hated the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. When it comes to really, really, really freaking me out when I was a kid, it just haunted my dreams. I'd be both hungry and scared at the same time, which is an unfortunate mix. But my answer here is actually from a TV miniseries, Gulliver's Travels, from I think 1995 or 1996, which was shown in the UK on Channel 4, was something viewed as something I could watch maybe later than I normally could have, because it was like educational and about a book and based on a book, so really I was just learning. In reality, I was getting absolutely, really rather messed up by this one scene where Gulliver, played by Ted Danson, by the way, the immortal Ted Danson, gorgeous face, gorgeous chin, gorgeous man.
I don't think he's immortal.
Is he not?
No.
Really?
I'm pretty sure.
Oh. Well, we'll Google that. And he gets essentially attacked by this giant wasp that crawls out of his back when he's having one of these weird, you know, he's not well in the head, that character. But that really, really got to me. It was a Jim Henson production, so it was like a real, quote-unquote, giant wasp, and that giant wasp haunted my nightmares. Oh my god, so awful. But anyway, if you haven't seen it at all, this miniseries, it won 5 Emmys and haven't even heard of it, just know this: it has Peter O'Toole, John Gielgud, Omar Sharif, Mary Steenburgen, Nicholas Lyndhurst, guys, Nicholas Lyndhurst, Kristen Scott Thomas, and my old school friend Tom Sturridge. They are all in this amazing miniseries.
Amazing. Do you think that Ted Danson, is that where he met Mary Steenburgen?
I couldn't possibly comment or work it out without looking it up.
Is that where you met Nicholas Lyndhurst?
With their torrid love affair. Mm. Yeah, well, we can only hope. There's also that great scene where you see him off Cheers, obviously, taking a slash on, I think, Blenheim Palace whilst it's on fire, and this girl walks out of her once aflame room drenched in piss.
Wow.
And that's very funny.
Thank God that he didn't record that on National Orgasm Day.
Yeah, that would have... would have been for a wood fire, I think.
Would have been.
So that's one of the great peeing scenes in popular culture, alongside the one from the trailer for Night at the Museum 3.
Oh, yeah.
Did everyone enjoy that?
I spotted
giant monkey piss.
A red bus with Cuban Fury on the side, just blasting past.
That was a great spot.
Yeah, it's just a great spot. There it is. Cross promotion between two studios.
I haven't seen the trailer yet. Is it one of those trailers where they cut to London and there's red buses and phone boxes and bobbies and
there's a bit with the four lines, one more than the normal football strip, are obviously they're in Trafalgar Square and they come to life, guys. They come to life. And then Robin Williams is there.
No way.
And there are snakes.
No way. That reminds me of the Ghostbusters, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. What would be the equivalent in London? Apart from the lions, obviously.
What, Bertie Bassett?
Yeah, I was going
to say. Yeah, would it be a massive Bertie Bassett?
I would love it to be a giant Tunnock's wafer just stumbling down the
mouth. Oh, you're going to make one of our, you're going to make one of our Scottish listeners very happy with that reference.
Yeah.
Were the marshmallow people from the opening ceremony of the Commonwealth Games?
What scared you when you were little?
I was going to say, we seem to have deviated somewhat from the question. The Jacob's Ladder for the under-12s, the Willy Wonka's tunnel sequence from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. With Gene Wilder, which is just really stupendously dark, even to this day.
The music.
The music, all of it, basically. All of the Dark Crystal and the closing bit of Raiders. Now, I know that you're more freaked out by the spectral angels, aren't you? And I was more of a melty face.
Yeah, it was always the angels. There's always that moment when they turn and Bella goes, "It's beautiful!" And then they go, "Ah, we're not beautiful. We're actually, you know, vengeful agents of God and we're going to destroy you."
And you're the meerkat from the ads.
Hello.
Compare the Nazi. Compare the Nazi.com.
Compare the Nazi.com. Yeah, no, that's a great scare. And because I was exposed to lots of horror films as a kid, because, you know, my parents were quite laissez-faire with that sort of thing. There's a great little B movie horror from the 80s called Superstition, aka The Witch. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. It's a really hokey. It's got lots of, it's very influenced by The Omen. It's got lots of weird deaths and stuff, but it's got its moments. And there was a moment towards the end where the witch, the evil presence that's in this haunted house, has been unleashed upon the family staying there, and someone's trapped in the kitchen, and there was a the door next to the kitchen is lit up by a spectral, spooky light, and you just know that there's evil on the other side of that door that's going to come and get you. And that, just that image of the light creeping under the door, scared the crap out of me. It's probably one of the reasons why I slept with my light on for many, many years. Not now. I'm okay now. But back in the day.
And then we realised when we grew up that there's really no evil at large more profound than the evil of a teenager's bedroom anyway. So if you're outside, you're probably better off. This is a great opportunity for me to plug. I promised I would. BBFC have got a new ad for their 12A certificate. They want everyone to watch it. So if you have any concerns about, fuck, that's boring, let's not bother with that.
Well,
cut the shit out of that.
Everyone
that's just losing the world to live.
With all the swears, we probably have to.
I was losing the world to live halfway through saying that.
By saying the F word, you've just got a 12A. So well done.
Bingo.
So there you go. It all ties in nicely.
I would like to say the thing that scared me most possibly was David Bowie's crotch in Labyrinth.
Just David Bowie's crotch. Kept me awake at night when I was a kid. Right. That's enough for the questions this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can Twitter us. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. You can hashtag it Empire Podcast. Otherwise, chances are we won't see it. You can Facebook us. We're Empire Magazine. You can email us podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first guest. The Inbetweeners movie, the big screen version of Damon Beasley and Ian Morris's hit E4 sitcom, wasn't just an unexpected success when it opened back in 2011. It was the biggest comedy of all time in the UK, grossing an astonishing £42 million. With numbers like that, it was only a matter of time before Will, Neil, Simon and Jay took the plunge for a sequel, and lo and behold, The Inbetweeners 2, which opens next Wednesday, sees a quartet head to Australia for some hijinks. And speaking of hijinks, that's exactly what happened with The Inbetweeners themselves. Simon Bird, Joe Thomas, Blake Harrison, and belatedly, when he eventually showed up, James Buckley, arrived in this very pod booth to talk to me. It was, as you might expect, chaos, but enjoyable chaos. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined in the pod booth. This is going to be utter chaos, because there's going to be 5 people in a 4-microphone booth, which is very interesting. I'm joined by the stars of The Inbetweeners 2.
Hello.
Hello. Joe Thomas, Blake Harrison and Simon Bird. I know people will know your voices, but if you can just speak so people can identify you, because this is radio.
Hello, I'm Blake.
I know, I did that. It's pointless.
Hello, I'm Simon Bird.
Hello, I'm Joe Thomas.
Good, that's helpful. Something for people really, you know, hang their hats on as the interview goes on.
Yep.
Guys, you've been reading the Empire feature that's in the most recent issue, where we made you, undergo lots of, I guess, Australian cliches, humiliation via Australian cliche.
Yeah.
The film's largely set in Australia. Which cliche proved most true?
Probably us, sort of our pastiness and meagerness in comparison to the Aussies is probably pretty true.
They're a superior specimen of man. I think it does make you feel quite emasculated.
It is. It's men and boys. It really is.
But apart from that, guys with abs and. It just made you feel bad on the general level.
Well, yeah, I mean, we filmed quite a lot of stuff in a water park where I think we were obviously in our trunks and, well, that's it, isn't it? That's all you wear in a water park.
Trunks and a bow tie.
There was no way to finish that sentence in a way that actually would be true.
The old wet waistcoat.
Goggles.
Yeah. Goggles, yeah. And, yeah, I suppose I've never really felt comfortable with my shirt off in a way that some men do, but I think if you're in England or if you're around other English blokes, I mean, English men take their shirts off and they haven't got very good bodies, and so you kind of would fit in. But in Australia, they actually do. Everybody's kind of ripped. Is that?
Yeah. That's the term. Yeah. That's the way to.
So
stacked,
ripped and
hench. Hench, yeah. Like a bench.
Well, yes.
Oh, that's a new one.
Yeah. So, I don't even know the language for being muscly. This is the, I don't even know the vocabulary.
Bulgy.
You're bulgy. Yeah. Yeah.
Swollen.
Yeah. Lumpen.
Yeah. Although, I mean, actually, having said this, although actually most of the times we were in the water park, it was before it was opened. The agreement
the
we had in the water park
times
was
I've yeah. ever had. Yeah, we were getting picked up at like 2 a.m. to go and start filming at 4 a.m.
Yeah,
and yeah, it was really weird because it'd get to about 9 a.m. and you'd think it was like 3 p.m. and because it was so sunny over there and so hot, it looked like it was as well. Your body clock was really out of shape.
Yeah, well, everything was
out of shape, mate.
The other cliche that the Australians very much subscribe to is just everyone's got a nickname.
Yeah.
Everyone in the crew had a nickname, and it took me so long to get to grips with it.
Yeah.
The guy who did who was responsible for the stunts was referred to by everyone as Halfy, and it honestly took. I had to ask him about 10 times to find out his name was Paul.
Why did they call him Halfy?
Because he's quite short, so he's half a man. he was really happy with it as well. He did not see that as offensive in any way.
Yeah.
He was like, "Yeah, I'm Halfy." So no, you're not, you're Paul.
So where do you guys stand on nicknames? Do you have nicknames for each other?
We can't say Blake, unfortunately.
We have actually... Well, we used to have... what have we had?
We don't really do nicknames.
Well, we had...
Blake had a good one,
which was you had one take, Blake.
That was true.
Because you only ever had one take, because he was good.
And then it was Wiggly.
Wiggly Blake.
And then, of course, it moved on to its current incarnation. Which I'm not at liberty to say.
Yeah.
Is it because it's too rude for a podcast?
Yeah,
it's definitely
too rude. It's too rude to Blake.
How do you feel about this nickname that can't be said?
I'm not massively happy with it.
Do you know
quite insulting, quite demeaning, and it makes me sad.
There's a single tear rolling down your cheek.
Yeah, there is.
What would James's nickname be? Because he's not here yet.
Well,
we've
got Bucky O'Hare. We've had for
have
Buckley.
We? Have we?
Quite literally never heard that.
You know who Bucky O'Hare is, though, in the first instance.
Yeah, but
he's a sort of space going rabbit.
I've never.
With a hair.
Have you ever
Even
referred to him?
Buckers, I suppose.
Buckers.
Isn't it?
No, we got one for Ian, one of the writers. Mm-hmm. We refer to him as Podge.
He literally, this is like
back
during
the,
like, the second
day,
series, he put on like the tiniest bit of weight, like not much at all. But from now on, it's like whenever you're doing a wide shot, that's a Podge shot. That's Ian Morris. Various different.
Yeah, whenever songs. The trucks arrive with all the equipment, that's his breakfast arriving. Yeah.
And when we sing a song about Ian Morris, it's like, he ain't heavy. Oh, wait, he is. Ian Morris Podge.
Amazing. In our Set Visit feature that ran a couple of issues ago, you guys seemed to take the slate for every take and wipe off Ian Morris and Damon Beasley's names. And
some
other
we really like Damon.
With
Damon's great.
Fat.
Oh, wait. We have a late arrival. Go.
Here he is.
Hello.
James Buckley's finally arrived.
Or as we like to call him, Bucky O'Hare.
Oh, the hair man.
Oh, is that another gag, mate? Oh, cool.
Yeah. Hello.
How's it going?
Carry on.
As you were.
Yeah.
Classic Bucky, eh?
B-O-H. Here he is.
Welcome. You're going to share a microphone because, you know, we're punishing you for being late.
Fine.
But, yeah, that's fine. Was traffic bad?
They were asking about our nicknames. We obviously couldn't share Blake's. But Joe revealed that the nickname that we all refer to you by apparently is Bucky O'Hare. Have you ever been called that?
I mean, yeah, well, I mean, well, maybe once. Obviously behind my back.
But I mean, I don't think it's even a behind your back one. I mean, it's not a. But I'm sure we've called him Bucky O'Hare once. Well, I mean,
that's not how a nickname works, is it?
No. It's not something you've been... not just a quote. It was once said of James.
So we were talking about how you guys torture Ian and Damon, who graduated from writers and creators to directors on this one.
That's right.
You were wiping out their names
on
slates.
Yeah, we did have a little joke.
You say graduated as well. It's like, you know, like, I don't know...
Well, they graduate.
A woman that's married like a wealthy man.
Yeah, or it's like,
and he's now bringing out a single or something like that. Like he's paid for it all.
Yeah,
it's like graduating from like a special school.
Yeah. Yeah, we could have made things easier for them. Looking back, I do feel a twinge of regret.
But. Yeah. Was it Ian the one who got most of the flag?
Yeah,
he's the funniest to get rise from. Damon's a bit more laid back.
Yeah.
And Ian's ready to snap it.
Yeah. It was good. I think the most anger I've ever seen him was that day we, me and old Bucky O'Hare developed a
hair boy here.
We developed a new joke of whenever we got a note from Ian of like pat him on the head, being really patronising, telling him he's doing a really good job.
I just like that joke.
It was like a sick child that won a competition or something. Like, do you want a photo with the boys afterwards? Do you want to be a director when you're older? Yeah. That kind of thing was
in
going
terms
on.
Of the
may have been a step too far.
Yeah, the kind of the heart, the patience sort of threshold with that one, the time that it took from indulging it in a good humoured way to being genuinely pissed off. It's much shorter than any of the other. Like that one.
I still don't quite know how he feels about it because it's like, I mean, we found it hilarious. We were laughing in his face.
Yeah, couldn't be closer to his face.
And that justifies anything.
Yeah.
That on the set of The Inbetweeners, if something's very very funny, then you're allowed to do anything as long as it's funny. So every time. He kept saying, no, I get it. It's very, very funny. I find it funny. I find it really funny. Like, I think it's great. Like, I find it funny.
We were like, why are you laughing then? He's like, I'm not laughing because
he was saying it was such a straight, miserable place. I didn't quite believe him.
Have those guys gone Hollywood, though? Because those guys write over there, don't they, now? They have their... Largely based over there.
Sort of.
Kind of. They're squatting, I believe, in LA.
Yeah. Ian's got an American wife. And he spends a lot of time in America.
Mm-hmm.
Just podging out. Podging all over the world.
Well, what about you guys? Have you been tempted to go Hollywood? So, I mean, you know, the first movie made more money than God.
Oh, so. God, they come knocking, don't they? But,
just leave me alone. Know, can you give me 5 minutes, please? I'm trying to...
Please, I'm just trying to promote the second Inbetweeners film. And then, yes, I'll come and be in all of your films.
Yeah, can take a rain check.
Taking a little break at the moment. Yeah. But.
No, we haven't, have we? No, I mean, we...
Obviously we haven't.
Look at us! No, it's sad. It is quite sad, actually, career prospects, but...
Well, I mean,
we'll be fine.
To be fair, I mean, The Inbetweeners has got some following stateside. I think Anglophiles.
Did you not hear about the first film? We made, I don't know whether you've heard of a little known figure of $32,000 at the box office.
$32,000? What? Yeah. Oh, individual thousand? 32?
No, I reckon after this second film, Hollywood's definitely going to come knocking. Definitely. Yeah. I was at the Harry Potter tour.
Yes.
A studio tour last night,
okay.
And Idris Elba was there, big star, big massive star.
Yeah, yeah.
And
big fan.
I made him crack up because I said the joke. Oh, this is all a bit of a novelty for me because this is the closest I'm ever going to get to a big budget film. Wouldn't stop laughing.
Was that not a little patronising?
He laughed a little too long. And a little too loud. All right, it's just all right. I mean, all right, stop laughing now.
Oh, so stop laughing. All right, write it in. Come on.
All right.
But obviously, this one was, this one set in Australia. And I know you guys shot in Marie, is it? So is it one of those places whenever you guys were there, they
It's one that they paint the population on the sign. So when they changed it to 71.
Yeah,
the
bigger sign. I mean, it was. I think the town population is more people who are there and passing through. I mean, there's a pub, lovely pub actually, that we all sort of stayed in.
Oh, it was great. I think that was the most fun.
That was the highlight.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Because there was absolutely nothing to do there. It meant we all had to talk to each other.
No internet. No. Yeah.
Which was really great.
Yeah, but no, I mean that was, I genuinely loved being in Māori.
Australia is home to the 10 most venomous land snakes in the world.
Yes.
It's the reason I haven't gone, because I'm terrified.
Well, yeah, we were terrified. But then
one snake.
We moved from terror to kind of sort of lurid interest in seeing a snake to eventually just disappointment. Didn't see a damn thing. We saw...
I mean, where we were in the outback as well, we were like promised, you know, so much wildlife and... Like there wasn't an animal stupid enough.
We got so excited because we one day because we saw an emu, so we ran to check it out. It was a bush.
It was a bush with a broom handle next to it. So that looked like the neck, and the bush looked like the body.
That's it. Yeah. That's as dangerous as it got.
Yeah, it was. Well, no, the one.
Well, it's just because the desert was like, there was nothing living in the desert. I mean, it was unbelievably hot. All you had was flies.
Flies and flies everywhere. There were so many flies in your eyes, in your ears, just absolutely everywhere.
Yeah, I mean,
Ian and Damon were like, "Oh, don't worry about them. They'll never show up on camera." And through the whole editing process, they've said, "Oh no, it's fine. Told you they didn't show up on camera," and they've just done the, they've just got into the dub or whatever it's called, and in high definition, they're very visible.
Damned flies,
yeah, amazing. Incredibly visible, just all over the place.
Yeah,
I've thought you guys
quite off-putting.
Yeah,
I can imagine.
Lord of the Flies,
and is this going to be the last time you guys are on screen as the Inbetweeners? Do you think, or? Or do you think there might be more down the line?
I was surprised we were doing this one.
Podcast.
Yeah, I think it is the last one, unfortunately. Just, it takes a long time. It's quite a hassle to sort it all out.
It's the breaking of the fellowship, really. I mean, that's Blake has to go back to his group of elves. Yeah. Simon back to his group of men. And me back to my gang of dwarves.
They'll do a prequel or something like that. Yeah.
And the last thing is, obviously, the Pythons are doing this this amazing run of shows at EO2. Yeah. So maybe in 50 years' time, can we see that?
Maybe. I'd like if we were to do it, it'd be sort of like less cynical. Like, sort of like... not cynical, but like... What I find so interesting is...
Oh, you mean that they're kind of taking the piss out of themselves?
Yeah, I guess. Obviously, it's Pythons, so it's just sort of absolutely covered in irony.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but what
it's got one down, five to go.
I think so.
This is what I found quite funny.
Yeah.
I'd like one of us to die as well.
Me too.
Yeah.
Do you agree, James? So all those in favour of one of the dying? James, Joe, me?
Yeah, I'm in favour of Wiggly dying.
Yeah.
I mean,
do I not get a say?
You don't need to vote.
You don't need to.
You don't ever again. You won't be needing those.
But they, what was interesting ideas about anymore. A lot is how I just thought they'd be much better friends. I just thought they liked each other a lot more, but they were just sort of a lot of them, you know, they found each other quite irritating.
Well, same
whereas
many of them.
Three of us, like the three of us.
Three of us,
we get on really well.
In a way,
it's sort of made us stronger.
Blake's right there, guys. I can see him.
Yeah. And this is what you have to put up with on set all the time.
Maybe we should bring Podge in
You need a Podge bailout here because, well, you won't be able to see us or hear us because Podge will be absorbing all sound and light.
Well, like I say, he's coming on the podcast soon. Do you think he'll fit in this room?
If he does, I mean, there's loads of stuff you've got to worry. Like, usually his ears are just clogged up with cheese. So you need to talk very loudly.
Yeah,
he'll spray food all over whoever he answers a question and then immediately, like, lick you to get it all back in his mouth again. He is fat.
If he yawns, you might be sucked into the vortex. Yeah.
So. I'll take that chance. I'll see how it goes. On that note, I have to let you go. Guys, it's been a pleasure. Joey, Bucky O'Hare, Wiggly?
Wiggly.
And Birdman. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
How did you get them all in here?
Well, it's big enough.
Yeah,
it's big enough room. There was, you know, I sat there where Ali's sitting, and then we had four chairs. It's a very boring story, Phil, but basically we can get five people in this room.
Like former.
No one was sitting on anyone's laps. I think Blake and Simon. Okay. Blake and Simon shared a microphone.
Cozy.
And that's it.
I'll give this fucking anecdote 12A.
Oh my god.
Ooh, hello.
This is just the home of dull anecdotes. Anyway, speaking of which, it's movie news time. Normally we talk about stuff, but I guess we want to talk about Comic-Con.
I need to grill you.
You need to grill me. James Dyer and Nick DeSimley were also in Comic-Con with me later. Don't make it to the podcast. They fell at the first hurdle, so it's up to me to talk about it, but I don't want to just talk about it. I don't want a monologue. So, Ali, grill me.
I would like to know just how awesome Robert Downey Jr. was. He's so awesome.
Oh, no. He came on with a suit. Oh. He was dancing to Michael Jackson. Oh.
He had like tinted sunglasses.
Lovely hair. Oh, actually, he had roses. He had roses for people. He was giving out roses to all the females in the Avengers cast, which, let's be honest, there was just two of them there. Kobe Smulders, the lovely Kobe Smulders, and Elizabeth Olsen, the lovely Elizabeth Olsen. Scarlett Johansson, she was pregnant.
But they're all very talented.
And she wasn't there. They're all very talented and all had smashing blouses on.
I want to ask you the most important question.
Yes.
What is he like?
he's just like a bundle of fun, isn't he, really? He's just like, he's almost exactly like Tony Stark. Almost exactly like him. Except for the beard. Oh, he had a beard! It's so good! It was so good.
Josh Brolin was there being Thanos, right?
Josh Brolin came out at the very end as Thanos. Not as Thanos, he wasn't, you know, dressed up as a big purple fella, but he is glimpsed in Guardians of the Galaxy. We'll get onto that in a second, and also in our spoiler podcast. But we do see Thanos. We hear him speak for the first time in Guardians of the Galaxy. He is voiced by Josh Brolin, who I think is also doing the full mocap thing as well. But Josh Brolin's casting was confirmed on stage at Comic-Con. He came out at the very, very end of the Avengers 2 panel wearing the Infinity Gauntlet, which was the must-have Hasbro toy at this year's con, which is basically Hulk hands, but one Hulk hand and painted a different color and with the Infinity Stones in it instead. So that's what Thanos wants, ultimately. That's what the Marvel Universe is building towards, I guess, in Avengers 3. And Josh Brolin came out and he was challenging the Avengers. I challenge you, Avengers. And Downey gave him a rose as well, and Brolin ate it.
This is getting pretty sexy.
He ate the rose. The undertones were not lost on me, but then again, they so seldom are.
You're very good at spotting the undertones.
There's another good one now. Fergal Sharkey just walked past the window.
Hey.
There you go.
And we've got their rivals. The big rivals were, I guess, DC.
Big rivals were DC. Yes, Marvel brought a couple of things. Marvel brought Ant-Man footage, and they brought Ant-Man director and cast. They brought Peyton Reed out. That was the very first thing Marvel did. Peyton Reed, Paul Rudd, Michael Douglas, Evangeline Lilly, finally confirmed as Hope Van Dyne, who is the daughter of Hank Pym and Janet Van Dyne. Marvel fans will know that that's the original Wasp, so draw from that what you will. And they also brought out Corey Stoll, who'll play the bad guy, Darren Cross, a.k.a. Yellow Jacket. And it was an interesting panel, the Ant-Man panel, because obviously Comic-Con, the whole Edgar Wright situation has been so prevalent over the last few months. And there was a guy outside Comic-Con, outside the Hall H, outside the whole convention center, who was parading around with a sign saying Edgar Wright was right, and he was parading around for 3 to 4 days. So I actually honestly thought that Peyton Reed was going to get booed when he was brought out on stage, and he didn't. He got a polite ripple of applause. He didn't get people braying and cheering and screaming his name, as I think Edgar would have done. But he brought with him his cast, who all looked, you know, fairly bewildered, as I imagine you would do in that situation. And he brought some footage that they'd filmed, some test footage, I guess, with Michael Douglas and Paul Rudd. Their voices, we didn't actually see them. We saw Ant-Man in the suit riding a giant ant and jumping off what looked like a building but turned out to be a computer server. And the effects were good and it was fine. And I think it placated people, and I think it went some way to showing that, you know what, they might be able to salvage this.
He's not Edgar Wright, is he? But he's not a newcomer to Comic-Con, Peyton Reed. He's been there a lot. So.
As he said himself, it was his. They were very, very much at pains to establish his credentials, A, as a geek, and B, as an Ant-Man fan. And you can absolutely see why. It was his 20th Comic-Con. across the years, he was name-dropping Jack Kirby. He's, you know, he once had a punk band called Johnny Quest, for when he drew the flyer for their very first gig, and he made the band into Avengers, and he was Ant-Man. So, you know, he's saying that, you know, I'm a massive fan. He's not Edgar Wright. Very few directors are. And I do wonder that, you know, Edgar's stylistic flourishes, I think, would have really set Ant-Man apart. And I do wonder if this one's going to be a little bit more generic. But the footage was good. Footage was fine. Second part of the Marvel panel was obviously Avengers. They brought them all out on stage, bar Scarlett Johansson. Even James Spader was there. He's going to voice Ultron. The footage was fantastic. For a full breakdown, you can go to the Empire website. But it had some images that were just fantastic, and had the Marvel fan in me going, oh my god, this could be genuinely something special. We saw Hulk versus Hulkbuster, which is Iron Man's armor souped up to take on the Hulk. We saw a scene of Thor grabbing Stark by the throat. We saw Ultron's first arrival, crashing an Avengers party where they're celebrating, getting up some hijinks, and it just looks good. And it finished off with a scene of Captain America's shield shattered in three, and Stark looking utterly distraught as the Avengers lie around him at his feet, defeated and seemingly dead. But I'm sure that's not the case.
This seems pretty unequivocally win-win-win for Marvel. Sounds like, you know, they got away with the Ant-Man thing, bit of a stumble, but then they have this humongous super Avengers, everyone but Scarlett Johansson, plus footage, plus that incredible poster they did.
Yeah, that was great. Love that poster. If you haven't seen the poster, go online. It's great.
It's really good. We have this big expanded thing on the website too. But how in any way could DC match that?
Well, I think the only way they could match it was to bring some Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice footage. Dawn of Justice. It feels like they should always be accompanied by brackets. And Devin Faraci does this every time he mentions it on his website. He does a little asterisk by the title, and then at the very, very bottom he goes, yes, that is the real title. It does feel like they should do that in brackets afterwards. But they brought some footage. They weren't on the official Warner Brothers roster. Warner Brothers started off the panels in Hall H, which is the massive, cavernous, 6,500 capacity mega room at the San Diego Convention Center. And that's where basically all the massive presentations, movie presentations, take place. And to get in there on Saturday, people were queuing up from midday the day before and sleeping out overnight, camped out outside Hall H. I mean, they're really desperate to get in there. And of course they're shattered by the time you get in there, and they smell quite badly, but that's fine, that's beside the point. So Warner Brothers were kicking off the panel. On the panel was Mad Max Fury Road. Footage is great, it's online if you want to check it out. George Miller was there as well, and The Hobbit, the Battle of the Five Armies, that was there as well. They only brought the teaser trailer, which is also now online, but it was a very, very fun panel moderated by Stephen Colbert, who is possibly the world's biggest Tolkien geek, and he was great. But they didn't advertise Batman vs. Superman. Now, I thought for sure they're going to bring something, because we knew the Avengers were going to turn up. We knew that Marvel were going to pull out all the stops at the very end of the day. I just didn't think that Warner / DC were going to give up without a fight and let Marvel own the day. And lo and behold, they didn't. The very, very first thing we saw was concept art from Batman vs. Superman. Some notable stuff. I think we saw...
Wonder Woman was the biggest thing, wasn't it?
In terms of the concept art?
Oh, wait, sorry.
No. We saw some concept art. It was basically, there was one shot of Superman walking out of what seemed to be an alien spaceship in the Arctic, presumably heading to a fortress of solitude. his local fortress of solitude, his cost cutter, if you will, carrying someone who could have been Lois. And then Zack Snyder came out on stage, talked for a second or two, and then said, I brought some footage. And it was possibly the I don't know. It was almost like if you fed all the coordinates into a geek computer and gone, what could possibly placate people? What could possibly get people excited in this room? People who've been quite cynical about this movie, been quite cynical about Ben Affleck's casting as Batman. This is the clip, I think, that will do that. It was a really good clip. It's Batman for a very, very short clip. Ben Affleck as Batman on a roof in Gotham, in a souped up, bulky Bat power suit, if you will, that I guess he's specially built to take on Superman. He does very similar in Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. Glowing white eyes, looks really cool, pulls the tarpaulin off something on the roof, it's revealed to be the Bat signal. It's shining into the sky, camera pans round, we see the light hitting the clouds, the Bat symbol is there shining on the clouds, and then hovering in the middle of the Bat symbol is Superman. And people were already losing their shit at this point, but then when they saw Superman, And there was just something about those two characters being together in the one scene. It had never been done before, and then that was pretty cool. And people who'd maybe been critical of the movie just completely forgot that they were being critical of the movie and just lost it. And there was Superman standing, hovering in the sky, looking down at Batman, looking not best pleased. His eyes glow red with burgeoning heat vision. And then we cut back to Batman, or rather Zack Snyder cuts back to Batman. I had nothing to do with it. Cuts back to Batman, pushes in his face as Batman grimaces. And the battle is on. And then presumably they'll battle for a bit. They realise they're actually best friends and go and kick Lex Luthor's butt.
Yay.
Yay. Good clip. Looked great. Very good special effects. As with the Age of Ultron footage as well, they're really trying to push the boat out, I think, in terms of getting these sequences over to people, over to the effects houses as quickly as they can, not just for Comic-Con, but also just to get them done as quickly as we can. So the Hulkbuster stuff looked really, really good also.
Now, obviously, there's a load more stuff that went on in Comic-Con, and we had that 10 best stories.
Yeah.
There's lots of stuff on the site to go look through.
Yeah. Honestly, it was until Saturday, until the big Marvel DC brouhaha, it was a slightly underwhelming Comic-Con for me. There was a sense that certain studios were giving it a bit of a wide berth this year. Legendary Pictures turned up as well. They made some big announcements. They made the announcement that Godzilla 2 is happening after Gareth Edwards finishes his dalliance with the Star Wars universe, and it's going to happen, and it's going to come out 2018, something like that. It's going to have three bad guys. Godzilla's going to be fighting Rodan, Ghidorah, and Mothra, so that's cool.
Surprisingly subdued response to that, and surprising announcement in some ways, isn't it, that they're actually going to be doing it?
Not really.
You don't think so? The first film didn't destroy it at the box office.
No, but it's made close to $500 million worldwide. And it's still opening. It just opened in Japan to big numbers. So I think that they'll feel Godzilla 2, I think, will be the test case. Frankly, if they gave they've given the sequel to Pacific Rim, which made $400 million worldwide, and I think the feeling is that the sequels can build on what the first one did, which is traditionally the model for sequels. So I think they'll be thinking the sequels might make 500, 600, 700 million. And if it doesn't, okay, then we won't make any more. But if it goes on, then it can become a trilogy. And clearly, I think Legendary might be building as well towards a Godzilla King Kong thing, because they also announced Skull Island, which came out of nowhere. They announced some footage. They had a teaser trailer for something which involved lots of jungles and rivers and lush, dense vegetation. And we thought, well, this is going to be a Jurassic World trailer. Turned out to be nothing of the sort. It was a teaser for Skull Island, which seems to be some sort of King Kong origin story or King Kong prequel, which has been dated for 2016, despite the fact it doesn't have a director. And they've approached Joe Cornish, who has flirted with the likes of Star Trek 3 and A Good Day to Die Hard, and didn't get Die Hard 5, and he's probably thanking his lucky stars he didn't, and he didn't get Star Trek 3. And I do wonder, though, I think Cornish is a smarter guy than that. I don't think he'll take Skull Island, but you never know. It might turn out to be a fantastic property, but it was certainly interesting. But in this world of shared universes, King Kong, Godzilla being owned by the same company, is, I think, we're building towards something. Even though, as someone pointed out in my Twitter feed, this Godzilla would be able to stomp that King Kong and not even feel it.
There's so much going on here, but there's one little bit of, oh, what a coincidence, something else comic book and nerdy happened just towards the end, I believe, of Comic-Con. Tim Miller is an established and well-respected visual effects artist. He has worked on the likes of Babe, Pig in the City, Life of Pi, Golden Compass, you know, all that sort of Rhythm and Hue stuff. He's been part of that company for a long time now. He is the guy who also did special effects for X-Men 1 and 2, and he is the guy who has recently released, I think it's a couple of years old, actually, this footage. It's been around for a while, only now was it leaked. But it's footage of Deadpool, the Merc with a Mouth. Ryan Reynolds infamously half got it right, half accidentally got it horribly wrong when his character of Wade Wilson got amalgamated into this weird power-stealing, fighting on the top of Didcot Power Station nightmare.
Yeah.
At the end of X-Men Origins Wolverine. And people have, I think, quite rightly dismissed what they did with it, at least, as terrible. But he himself, as a cocksure, fourth-wall-breaking, funny man, who is also, you know, physically the right shape and size and kind of has that presence, is, to my mind, a good Deadpool. He does get that right. And in this footage, which is about a minute or so long, you see him do all the stuff you'd expect, break the fourth wall, make silly asides, as he beats up about three or four goons inside a basically a 4x4 as it drives through an underpass. And he's very funny. I enjoyed it a lot for the comedy. And also he gets to kick butt and kind of mess around a bit. What they did is they took Ryan Reynolds and they performance captured him. It's not actually him. He wears the red and black leather type outfit with the two katanas in the back and obviously the pistols. And yeah, he just essentially kicks ass in this very small confined space and is funny. And also in the back seat, there is just into the back pocket of the seat, you can see a copy of Empire, which they snuck in as a gag, which guess which one cover it is? That's right, X-Men Origins Wolverine, that blue, cool, smoky, cloudy cover we did. So it's great to see that. Obviously fun to be part of that. And at the end it says, isn't that right? He says to the camera...
He says hi Tom at the end of the piece, which is a shout out to Tom Rothman, who was the Len head of Fox. Clearly didn't work, but I don't know the timing of this, the leak, the day after Comic Con, when Deadpool was everywhere. I took loads of shots of people cosplaying as Deadpool, very very popular character. Could be seen to be a little. Yeah. Suspicious, testing the waters, possibly see what the reaction's like. Looks good. Whether it can sustain a film, I don't know. But you're right about Ryan Reynolds. And he got a lot of flack for Deadpool in X-Men Origins Wolverine. First of all, the character's never called Deadpool. It is Wade Wilson. But the thing that appears at the end is never actually called Deadpool. It's called Weapon 10, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Weapon
11. Yeah, or something like that. It's truly dreadful. And Reynolds has admitted that. And he's even said in the past that he knew going in what that character was going to end up like. And as a Deadpool fan, he's a massive fan, he was a little offended by it, but he was damned if he was going to let anyone else play Wade Wilson. So he went for it anyway. Mm. So I think if they get the chance to rectify their mistake, then this is a good sign.
This would be within and without this being Deadpool, their idea for the script, which has been written by Paul Wernick and Rhett Reese, are the guys behind Zombieland, so it has been written, people have seen it, has been read, is that it would be aware of, this is what Ryan Reynolds said to us, you and I, Phil, just last year, about this time last year, where it is a world where he is aware how terribly Deadpool was represented, Wade Wilson was represented in the X-Men Origins Wolverine universe. So there you have it. Yeah, there is fun to be had with that. He apparently is just one, you know, the script is one edit short of him jumping over the desk of the studio executive and slicing his throat. Also, I should point out in this footage, it is bloody. There is swears. Yes. And, you know, there's a decapitated head. So it really does deliver on the Deadpooliness of all.
Indeed. I do love the fact that Empire makes a cameo in there. I'm not so happy about the fact that it's clearly the bad guys who are reading it, not Deadpool, but that's neither here nor there. But it's been a good week for famous people and Empire, because Mark Hamill, a.k.a. Luke Skywalker, was snapped in Ireland, arriving in Ireland with a copy of Empire tucked under his arm. So God bless you, sir, if you're listening to this, and all is hail on you. And thank you. If you want a free subscription, then email us, podcast@empireonline.com.
Yeah, check out the picture. It's on our Facebook page. Do check it out. Do you want to say some news from your mouth, Phil?
I'm assuming he's already a subscriber, Mark Hamill, you'd have thought. Orlando Bloom and Justin Bieber. No, Jamie Foxx is in talks to play Mike Tyson. I think he's actually in talks with Mike Tyson, who seems to be heavily involved in this one. It's a biopic that will apparently involve Benjamin Button technology to de-age Jamie Foxx, who is now, I think, 46 years old, the star, of course, of such movies as Ray and Miami Vice and Collateral. And what are you laughing at?
I'm just laughing
at such great movies. And Django Unchained, of course, recently. And this year's Annie. So from Annie to Mike Tyson in one or two fell swoops, scripted by Terrence Winter, of course, the man behind Sopranos and The Wolf of Wall Street, and to a much lesser extent, Get Rich or Die Trying, which, although in fairness, that might be more of a template for this one, which is kind of a rags to riches to prison story, of course. And be interesting to see how this comes together. There's been some really superb boxing biopics in the past. I believe Paul Newman played Rocky Graziano. Of course, Robert De Niro in Raging Bull. Mm-hmm. We've had Russell Crowe in Cinderella Man. And Jamie Foxx as Mike Tyson. What do we think?
I want to see the button Mark Benjamin that will get this job done. It'll be incredible to see how they visualise or...
Is he going to be a tiny baby Mike Tyson in the ring, do you think? If he's going to go all the way back to... Maybe if they hit too much Benjamin Button.
Yeah. could go too far.
You move through all the weight brackets.
Pretty much when something has this kind of writer attached to it, and Jamie Foxx is a very good actor, as we saw in Amazing Spider-Man 2, I really want to see what can be done with this project. It's a very interesting life. Frankly, I'm all ears, and I can't wait to see how Jamie Foxx does his biting wit.
Could be interesting. I thought Ali was pretty solid, turgid stuff. This needs to be the warts and all story of
Ali.
There's plenty of
or
warts.
Ali.
Ali. Yes. Michael Mann's Ali.
Well, that hasn't actually been released in cinemas yet, but he's begging me for the official get-go green light approval. He kind of did on spec. I think that was his mistake. Mm. And I'm just summing up whether I can handle, you know, that much blue on my visage.
You're wearing blue right now. Obviously, this is an audio thing. People can't see, but Ali is wearing a blue jumper right now. Michael Mann was at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
He was at Comic-Con.
So was Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan at Comic-Con. Both of them wearing slightly pained expressions on their face, as if to say, why are we here? I don't want to be here. Please let me leave. I don't think they were among the celebrities who were taken to the floor in disguise. Daniel Radcliffe walked the floor as Spider-Man, apparently. Peter Jackson walked the floor as a... Well, not apparently, there's a shot of him doing it. Peter Jackson walked the floor as an evil jester as well. Michael Mann walked the floor as a man who was regretting his life choices. I think that led him to this point.
I think Christopher Nolan was walking the floor as Jareth. It's pretty good.
Nolan had never gone before. He made 3 Batman films and had never gone before.
That is a very, very... it's a statement to be proud of.
It is.
And now he's ruined it.
The Tyson biopic, I don't know, as long as they don't shy away from the fact that he has in the past been an absolute... How can we say this without...
We can't say
we
it.
We can't say it. But, you know, let's hope it doesn't shy away from some of the more...
It's got
distasteful elements of his life. Just want to mention for one very last thing, Dick Smith, the amazing makeup artist, one of the godfathers of modern makeup, passed away Thursday at the age of 92, a ripe old age. He was responsible for amazing makeup on The Godfather. He did Marlon Brando's makeup in The Godfather. He squibbed Jimmy Caan for the tollbooth sequence. The Exorcist, he's responsible for Linda Blair's look in that movie. Taxi Driver. Mm. And all sorts of other movies. Just his impact on the world of makeup is keenly felt. And he was hugely inspirational. There's great, very heartfelt tributes from the likes of the great Rick Baker and Guillermo del Toro, which you can find online.
There's a really good DVD extra on Taxi Driver of the way that they shot that final sequence in the corridor, and the finger coming off, and the way he'd...
Yes.
With a little, I think, fishing line, I think he'd used to yank it off, which is really interesting insight into the way that he worked. Check it out.
I also feel like we should point people towards Pint of Milk Monthly, as I'm now calling it. Empire magazine has a new issue.
It does. Thank you. I completely forgot about that. Yes, new issue of Empire is out. It is £3.99 in all good and evil newsagents, also available on the iPad. Thank you, Phil. Just handed me a new copy. It has 2 covers split run this month. Is The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies cover. Smaug, the Magnificent, is on one cover. Bard, the slightly less magnificent, but nonetheless Beaumanier, is also on the other cover, played by Luke Evans. Those two may or may not face off in the Battle of the Five Armies. Also inside are great features. We have a wonderful feature on the Hobbit. Nathan flew out to New Zealand, spent a lot of time in the edit suite with Peter Jackson, got some fantastic stuff. We have a great shoot, an interview with Peter Capaldi on the eve of his debut as the new Doctor Who. We have a fantastic feature on Sin City, A Dame to Kill For. Great profiles with John Hamm and Marion Cotillard. And I really love the feature about Lucy, Luc Besson.
Oh.
Who wrote that, Phil?
Oh, me, I wrote that one.
You wrote that
Yay.
One? Good, good, good.
That's very kind of you.
There's a great set visit from Exodus Gods and Kings, which is in the On Location section. George Miller talks Mad Max Fury Road. There's all the usual movie reviews and news and nonsense. And Brian Cox, the great Brian Cox, is one of the funniest pints of milk I've ever read, courtesy of Mr. Alistair Plum. So do check that one out. £3.99. Please go and buy it. Otherwise, I won't be able to pay my rent. And I'll lose my home. And I'll be penniless and on the streets. Time now for a second guest, or if you're keeping score at home, technically he's our fifth guest this week, but like the in-betweeners, he's a sitcom star hitting it big on the silver screen. He is, of course, Chris Pratt, who's been consistently brilliant as the dumb but warm-hearted Andy Dwyer on Parks and Recreation for 6 seasons now, and he's been grabbing Hollywood's eye for a while with supporting roles in the likes of Zero Dark Thirty, Moneyball, and yes, Movie 43, but he's about to go stratospheric with the lead role of Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord, in Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, which opened this week. He's also the lead in next summer's Jurassic World. He came to London recently to talk to our very own Star-Lord, Ali, over breakfast.
Nice!
Right?
You know what? We're breaking ground. We're constantly breaking new ground, Ali.
This is incredible. I was just revealing to Chris, we're now recording because I'm that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
Chris is eating his breakfast. I would describe it as nutritious.
Yeah, I would describe it as delicious and nutritious.
It's got spinach going on. We got a little bit of scrambled eggs here. It's 9 in the morning on the massive Guardians of the Galaxy press day. Mm-hmm. I will be interviewing Chris 3 times today. It's going to be incredible.
That's a record.
It is an entirely new record. No one's ever
Ripley's,
done it before.
Believe it or not.
Now, in between you eating your food, I'm just going to quickly ask you a few questions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a movie, Guardians of the Galaxy, that has quite a few very special words for entirely new things. Like, you know, you have new guns, new worlds, new prisons. Everything's got a name. Everything's different.
Mm-hmm.
What is the name of your guns? What are they called?
Blasters.
They're just called blasters. They don't have any pet.
From what I understand, we just called them blasters.
And you've got these special boots as well that allowed you to kind of fly, kind of hover.
Yeah, thrusters.
Thrusters, boosters.
I've got blasters, thrusters, then I've got a lot of pretty cool gadgets, actually.
Yeah, and I guess you weren't allowed to keep any of them after the shoot.
No, I did steal my jacket, though.
You did?
Yeah.
That's
awesome. I have a Peter Quill jacket.
It's going to be a very good Halloween night when you bust that one out.
Yeah, I just picture myself 10 years from now, drunk and being escorted out of a children's hospital, squeezed into my Peter Quill costume, trying to convince them that I'm there to help, when really I'm just, like, stealing prescription medication.
I love the idea of you shouting, but I am Peter Quill, I'm Star-Lord.
And you're like, who? Like, exactly. And you're like, no, seriously.
My first, I guess, not even unserious question, but slightly silly question, is from my friend Phil,
mm-hmm.
who said that he saw a video of you where you were being interviewed and you started showing somebody how to braid hair.
Yes. Well, I grew up with a sister, so I knew how to braid. Had braided my wife's hair for, you know, every night for the past few years.
Wow. Well,
when we're together, she likes to have her hair braided. And yeah, that's a special skill, apparently. An intern's hair from Entertainment Tonight while I was doing an interview the other day, and people have just really run with that story. They're really excited about it.
Honestly, it was the last thing I was possibly expecting.
Me too. I kind of didn't even really remember doing it.
And there's so much, like, you've done before everything kicked off for you. Like, I was listening to the fantastic Kevin Pollak's show.
Yeah.
I discovered that I knew that you came from, like, a wrestling town.
Yes.
But you are in a movie here with a professional wrestler.
Yes.
If you were in the same weight category, and I'm guessing you're not.
Well, we are in the same weight category for mixed martial arts.
Interesting.
Which is anything over 205 is considered heavyweight. We would have, like, if I were ever a professional fighter, if I ever did that, I would have to fight someone like Dave Bautista. And I'm certain it would take no less than 20 seconds for him to paralyze me for life.
This sounds like an insult, but he is the size of 3 men. He just takes over the room.
Mm-hmm.
It must be difficult to, protect. I mean, you're fighting, obviously, you're not actually fighting on set, but you think we're all pretending to fight. You are actually capable of breaking out of a prison. There is a chance that you could possibly do this.
Mm-hmm. With our group?
Yeah. But
he
could actually, you know, kick down a door.
Yeah, people are always like, who would win between you and the Avengers? And I'm like, in a real street fight? We have Dave Bautista. Like, we'd beat anybody.
And the other thing I loved that I discovered is that you, and I was interviewing somebody else the other day, and they said they were a door-to-door salesman as well, but you, for a good couple of years,
yes,
actually sold it.
Mm-hmm.
Coupons, mm-hmm. door-to-door, preparing you for, you know, auditions,
yes,
obviously, in the future.
Oh, totally preparing me for auditions in the future.
And then you were salesman of the year. Mm-hmm. Is that plaque still in your house somewhere?
I do still have the bulletin. Yeah, I was pretty proud of that. They put your picture in there. Monkey Boy Pratt. I think I was Rookie Salesman of the Year.
Wow.
I broke some rookie records.
And then you got to go to Jamaica, is that
right?
I
got a free trip to Jamaica, that's right. I went to stay at Sandals Resort in Jamaica, where I had one of my very most embarrassing moments, spilling an entire tray of mudslides on the head of a girl named Carolyn that was like really super cute and from one of the other offices that I'd always sort of seen her picture in the bulletin and thought, man, that girl's cute. Oh, I can't believe I'm gonna be in Jamaica with Carolyn. And then I spilled a tray of mudslides on her on the formal night, like the night where everyone was dressed up and like dressed really nice. Anyways, Carolyn Cordova was not having it.
Yeah, I can imagine. And of course, you know that's the best chat up line I can think of, is mm-hmm. pouring several drinks over someone.
Yeah. It's like that, the secret or the game, you know? It's like if you really like a girl, dump a drink on her on accident.
Yeah, it's the final chapter of the game.
Yeah.
And finally, if all else fails, mudslider.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you get recognized for your work on The OC? Because there are fans of that show that are rabid.
I know. From time to time, it happens. Usually people like to inform me of the distinction. They're like, I love your work, but I loved you on The OC. It's as if to say I loved you first, you know what I mean?
I was there before you got cool.
Yeah, I was there before it was cool. I liked you before it was cool to like you.
Now, when I spoke to you on the phone for the magazine, you told me about the worst day you had on set, which was being underwater with an ear infection.
Yes.
On maybe the last or the penultimate day on mm-hmm. set for Guardians of the Galaxy. I wanted to ask you afterwards, what was your best day? Was there a day on the set of this film? You were saying it was like 85 days to shoot or something mm-hmm. like that. What was your best day when you went, this is it, I am living life?
There were a lot of those days. There were a lot of days. I mean, I think I would say, you know, the day that James Gunn walked me, that I arrived on set, walked into this like beehive of activity at Shepperton Studios, and they had this, essentially this war room, which is this giant, like essentially it's like a warehouse. Half of it was wardrobe, and the other half had been all the concept artwork. And so it was a scene by scene, you could essentially see what the movie was going to look like, what these vast worlds would look like with the colors of the sky. And it was everything that's going to inform the animators on making the movie. And so the first time I sat down, or actually just walked through and saw the look of the film, and I was looking at this concept artwork, some of the wardrobe concept artwork had my character, and they were pencil sketch drawings and it had my face on them. And that was the moment, that was like one moment that I'll never forget.
I look cool.
Yeah, I stole a couple of those drawings.
I have no doubt. And I suppose, obviously, you're asked a lot about Parks and Rec, and maybe you will give that answer as the question I'm about to ask you, but what is your favorite TV show on TV right now? What's the thing that's currently stuck in your mind that you want to end this interview right now and go and watch it?
Oh, man. I really like the UFC. I like UFC stuff.
So oh, really?
There's like a TV show called The Ultimate Fighter. I really like that. I, of course, love my wife's show, Mom, on CBS.
Well played.
Which is really very funny and endearing and charming show. What else? Of course, we love Game of Thrones.
Yeah, you're an HBO fan.
HBO fan. There's The Only Way is Essex.
Wow.
That show is hilarious.
Did you pick that up whilst you were here mm-hmm. shooting this film?
Yeah.
You are a magnificent human being.
Yeah.
The Only Way is Essex. These girls. Whatever. It's like, whatever. It's like, I said, like, John, whatever. It's like, cheat on me when I was on Ibiza. It's like, whatever, no, you know, like, we weren't together. It's like, yeah, but you said, like, you miss me. It's like, what is that? You like, am I your mother?
I don't know. Sometimes I wear ski goggles to the club because, you know, whatever. It's like, sort of cool. It's like my own look, you know?
This is fucking, guys, I love it so much. It's the Jersey Shore of...
And then some. And what about Geordie Shore?
Geordie Shore?
Oh, there's Geordie Shore. Your eyes are lighting up. It's like, Geordie Shore, I cannot do it justice with words. Yes. But your next mission, sir.
Yes.
Is to look up Geordie Shore.
I will. That sounds perfect.
That's incredible. Any other British TV that struck your fancy when you were here?
Yeah, that was the one that really grabbed me. It really grabbed my wife first because she loves all that stuff. Because we like just like the garbage on TV, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we love the dumpster fires. Like,
You like Finding Bigfoot.
That show's the worst. I have a tweet that I thought was pretty funny last year. I said, unless I missed an international news story, Finding Bigfoot should probably be called Not Finding Bigfoot. They don't find him. If they found him, it wouldn't wait to reveal it on a cable television show. It would be all over the news. There, we heard something. Over there. Where? Over there. Oh, we just missed it. It's like, come on, it's such bullshit.
Look, it's some hair. No, no, it's some deer hair.
It's a deer hair. We came this close.
But recently they went...
Oh, really? There's deer everywhere.
They went to, like, the Himalayas and just got in a helicopter and just flew around.
Yeah. Here we are in the Himalayas. Oh, there's mountains down there. We're close. I can sense it.
Anyway, that's a separate conversation.
Wow.
My other one is, we've got this little feature in the mag called What's Your Game?
Yes.
And I love the story of how, in some of the first auditions for Parks and Rec, you were playing GTA 4, like, as part of the,
yes,
the thing. And you discovered a cheat or a code that allowed you to, and I quote, was it drop a water ski or a hover?
Spawn a hovercraft,
yep,
and drop a it says, what are you, she's like, Andy, what are you doing? I said, oh, they just released a new cheat code for GTA. Look, I can spawn a hovercraft. Watch. I'm going to drop a hovercraft on this hooker. And I just did it over and over and over again until they finally were like, okay, Chris, we got it. You have to stop doing it.
You have to stop it. Here's the job, okay? Just
do the scene again. Do another scene. And I was like, heck yeah. Watch.
But are you a big gamer? I mean, do you when you're not watching The Only Way Is Essex?
You know what? I'm not. I don't even have a game system.
Wow.
I keep, like, Xbox and PlayStation keep giving me game systems, and then I just give them to my nephews.
Oh, the luckiest kids.
They're the luckiest world. Kids. They're like, oh, sweet. So yeah, I don't really have. I mean, I have a son who's 2, and I imagine he's gonna get into games at some point, and at that point, I'll probably reignite my passion for gaming. But
I mean, back in the day, were you really into, like, you know, Mario Kart or something? Or
yeah, I loved, like, original Nintendo back in those days. Yeah, it was like Super Mario Brothers. It's the Legend of Zelda, the original Legend of Zelda. Contra. Remember Contra? Akari Warriors.
This is like my brain is exploding.
Yeah. You know, obviously Tetris. You know, Mario Kart came out. I think Super Mario Brothers 2 came out. And I never... Like, I beat the original Super Mario's, but never beat Super Mario's 2. And I never had, like, a Nintendo 2 or whatever. I stopped at regular Nintendo.
We've just got a couple of minutes left, but I've got to ask you. You've currently got, let me count... Is it 2 or 3 characters in Lego of you?
Obviously, 3.
One's obviously Emmett, the Lego movie. You know, here you've got Peter Quill.
And I've just approved and seen the look for my character Owen in the Jurassic Park.
Amazing.
The Jurassic Park Lego that will be...
With the kind of a beigey top that we see on the motorbike, that's still...
No. That's just... No, it's a different look.
Oh.
It's a different look. My other look.
My
other shirt.
Your alternate outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ken and Barbie go to the beach. This is the different
This
outfit.
Is, yeah, this is Malibu Ken. I think I might be the only actor in history with 3. I think Sam Jackson, Harrison Ford, and that list, they've all had 2. I joined this, like, pretty exclusive list of having 2.
Shit.
As far as I know, I'm the only one with 3. The only one.
You're the only one with 3, and I'm interviewing you 3 times today, so I'll have to bring it up every single
Whoa.
Time. So it's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure's been mine. Thanks for letting me eat during this. I'm sorry that I was, like, probably scarfing and making crazy slurping sounds.
I edit the mother, so we'll see how this one works out in post. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet, man. That was nice.
And now here's the science bit about Squarespace, our lovely sponsors. And here to give you the science bit is Mr. Ali Plum.
Hello and welcome indeed to the science bit of the Empire podcast, where Ali the editor, that's me by the way, tells you just a little bit more about our sponsor Squarespace and how to make use of their free trial and discount deal. Thank you for listening. Always appreciated. Anyway, if you're not already in the know or missed Chris saying it earlier, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio or online store for a free trial. That means no money. And 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code EMPIRE25. EMPIRE25. 25 is the number not written out, just with 2 and then 5. You want more details, though, and that is understandable. So just for you, here are a few more reasons why you should use Squarespace. For starters, Squarespace is very easy to use indeed, as well as being user-friendly and doing all the tricky stuff for you, search engine optimization, hosting, and making your site mobile, tablet, portable device ready. Just for starters, they've also got a huge vault of pre-prepared designs and style options to be getting on with that you can tweak to your taste later on. Sign up for a year and get a free domain name. Yes! Enjoy an on-hand support team working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for you. And this is all for $8 a month, which, as I mentioned earlier, a free trial and 10% off your first purchase with the Empire Podcast's very own offer code, which is Sing It With Me. Don't sing it, please. I'm not going to sing it. Empire25 via squarespace.com. Again, thank you for listening. You are awesome people. I appreciate every one of you in an individual and unqualifiably wonderful way. goodbye for now.
Okay, let's start the review section with Guardians of the Galaxy, Marvel's biggest gamble to date. Before we do get into this, this is obviously going to be a truncated review. We will have a much, much deeper look at the film in our Guardians of the Galaxy spoiler podcast that will go up on Monday, August 4th, featuring James Gunn, the movie's writer and director, talking about the film's biggest secrets. Oh, and four of us idiots banging on about it as well. So bookmark it, earmark it, watermark it, do whatever the hell it is that you do, but please download it. So what is the film itself, Ali?
Right, well, this is a tough one because I want to explain to you a brief précis of what it's about. Obviously, there are some characters which you presume are Guardians of the Galaxy, and you might presume because it's of the galaxy, it's set in space. You're right, it is set in space, and it has aliens in it. They have multicoloured skins, and it's all very hip and vibrant and 60s and 70s and really lush and fun and exciting and kind of cartoony, but in the best possible way. Mm. But how do I set it up? Well... Well. This is a movie that has about 10 minutes, I think, of acclimatization, where you get used to Xandar, which is a planet, and the Kree, which are a race. And the Xandarians and the Kree, they're against each other. There's a radical member of the Kree. He's like a zealot. He's kind of like a fundamentalist. He's played by Lee Pace. He's got lots of patchy, weird makeup and a kind of cowl thing and a massive hammer.
What's his name?
His name is...
Ronan the Accuser.
He accuses people. He says...
Yes.
You are nasty.
He goes, yeah.
Go home. You've been bad. No, he doesn't say any of that.
He says, life is a roller coaster.
You've just got to ride it.
You say it best when you say nothing at all. He says stuff like that.
Classic
I wish
Ronan.
He said that.
Classic Ronan.
You say it best.
he does not sound like that anyway. He's the bad guy. And so who are facing off against that bad guy? Well, allow me to tell you, five people.
Westlife.
Well, I say five people, I mean five Irish singers. So there are five people. But when I say people, I actually mean one human.
Yes.
Played by Chris Pratt.
Yes.
He is Star-Lord, also known as Peter Quill. He was abducted at the age of 8, I believe, in the 80s. His mother, who's dying of cancer, gives him a mixtape called Awesome Mix Volume 1, and he gets abducted into space and becomes a member as he grows up of a group called the Ravagers, who are kind of headed up by a character called Yondu, who's blue and can kill people with a dart that he keeps in his back pocket and he can float around and go through people's eyes. He's played by Michael Rooker, and so he becomes this kind of thief, this charming, charismatic, obsessed with the 80s, you know, rogue. Then he gets involved with four other characters. One of them is another alien. This is an alien called Gamora, who's played by Zoe Saldana. She is slick, she has long blades, and she's an assassin. Then there's this absolute nut job, totally deadpan, mental case who can't really understand what people are saying in any way, but just about gets by. That's Drax the Destroyer. He's played by WWE wrestler known as Dave Bautista. Very nice man. Hands the size of iPads. He is then also joined by a human that is not a human. A tree, in fact. An arboreal menace. A big, massive plant called Groot. I am Groot are the only three words that he says. He is voiced by Vin Diesel. Then finally we have, as the final member of the Guardians of the Galaxy, you have the raccoon-like being. A cybernetic, cybernautic rocket machine who creates stuff out of stuff. He's a tinkerer. He has massive guns. He's very clever. He's wisecracking. He calls everyone an idiot. It's Rocket Raccoon, who's voiced by Bradley Cooper. Those are your Guardians of the Galaxy. They must follow the path of a MacGuffin, which Ronan wants. Ronan is enthralled to Thanos. It's all very complicated. It's all very space-based, but it is a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
And scene, I am sorry.
Done. It is a barrage of information at the very beginning of the film. You're given a lot of strange names and a lot of strange planets to process very, very quickly. But once you get past that, once you get a handle on who's who, I think this is incredibly fun. I've seen this film twice now, and I think it actually becomes more fun second time round once all the little surprises and things are wrinkled out, once you know they're coming. And this is a character movie first and foremost. There's good action sequences, but not great action sequences in this. For me, it's about spending time with these five characters, and right from the off, I think it's a really skillfully written script by James Gunn and Nicole Perlman, who is a Marvel in-house writer who started the script and then James Gunn took it over. I think it just really skillfully sketches out these characters very, very quickly. So the minute we see Chris Pratt, who you know, who's Star-Lord. He's dancing around. He's singing to himself. He's very roguish. You get who that guy is. You get who Drax is from the off. You get who Rocket is from the off. And even Gamora and Groot. But what the film does very, very skillfully as well is that it gradually reveals hidden depths to those characters. So by the end, for example, not to give anything away, we'll talk about stuff in the spoiler special, but this movie actually moved me in a way that I didn't think it would going into it. This was Marvel's biggest gamble. This is a comic book that not many people have read or heard of, and to turn it into a $200 million blockbuster was a huge risk, and I think it's really, really paid off. It is such a fun and such a funny movie that it feels like the best Star Wars film we've seen in a long, long time. Certainly since none of those prequels that people would give 5 stars to. We don't want to talk about those, but
they were funny though, really funny.
They were very funny.
I would like to say it wasn't quite as funny as I was hoping it to be, and maybe that's because they had an incredible trailer, a trailer that seemed to me to promise everything. And sometimes you can have a trailer that's almost too good for a movie, but it occasionally was a little bit flat with the dialogue. Rocket Raccoon tends to call just everybody an idiot, and I felt like I maybe wanted a bit more Shazam. That is not really that big a flaw. It is still a riot of colour and fun and at times extreme silliness, which you don't really see in many Marvel movies.
Also, it's not a superhero film. I think that's very, very clear to get that across. You can go into this having not seen any of the previous Marvel movies, even though Thanos does appear. And you can absolutely get on with this movie. And none of the characters are superheroes. None of them have superpowers per se. Drax and Gamora are a little stronger than your average humanoid. Groot can regenerate, but still, they're not flying around. They're not swinging magic hammers. They're not turning into massive green hulking beasts. And I think in that way, strangely enough, even though it features a talking tree and a talking raccoon, it's going to be more accessible for a lot of people. And I've got a feeling this one's going to be pretty big. And it's damned enjoyable. It does have flaws. The bad guys are very weak. Lee Pace is running the Accuser. Might have been more interesting had he started singing Boys Own songs. Otherwise, he's a little bit on the bland side.
Yeah, and the final act is a lot like the final act you've come to expect, I guess, from the past few Marvel movies. It still works. I agree with you on the emotional side of things. By the end of it, I went, this has been a 2-hour movie, and I genuinely care about these 5 characters. But
we'll get into that in the spoiler special, because I disagree with you to an extent. I still think that there's a spectacle, yes. Stylistic similarities or in terms of what happens in previous Marvel movies, maybe to an extent, but I still think the character stuff that happens within that is good enough to make it work.
I'm really chuffed about that, because I was never 100% sold on the James Gunn, Kevin Feige analogy about how the Avengers are the Beatles and these guys are the Rolling Stones. I think the Avengers are the Beatles, these guys are Westlife.
That's the worst review of this movie you have ever heard. No one's going to go see that movie now.
I am.
Okay.
I'd like to see it again.
Two tickets for the Westlife there.
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun, and I'd like to see it again.
Good. Good, good, good. They're not Westlife.
Westlife.
They're Bewitched. Good.
Bewitched. Okay. Westlife. I don't know. I just, the Rolling Stones, there's something else.
They're not the Rolling Stones.
There's another band out there that they are that isn't.
The Counting Crows.
Oh, God. Oh. Hootie and the Blowfish. Terrible.
No!
Early Genesis.
Stop doing this.
Early Sid Barrett era Pink Floyd.
The Undertones.
Yes! He's gone past again.
Duran Duran.
It's amazing. All right. Got one more film to talk about in Fig.
How many stars did we give it?
Oh, sorry. We gave it 4 stars. 4 stars. I thought that was presumed of what we were talking about. 4 stars for Guardians of the Galaxy. That is a recommendation. And also out this week, the other big film out this week is Michel Gondry's latest slice of, well, Gondrification. Mood Indigo, starring Audrey Tautou and Roman Jarry. Thoughts on this one? Phil, you have 2 minutes.
Thanks kindly. Gondrification, it's got a lot of the inventiveness that we know and love about him. You expect with Gondry that he's going to bring a story, but he's going to layer it and embroider it with kind of weird Heath Robinson touches of kind of mechanical stuff and mice and a machine that makes cocktails by according to the notes that you play on the piano, the piano octail. It's got this dance called the Big Limo, which is a sweeping the office at the moment. All of that stuff, lots of quirk and idiosyncrasy. What it probably doesn't have is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind's sort of emotional weight. It is a love story between Roman Jarry and Audrey Tautou's characters, in which it's not too much of a spoiler to say that one of them becomes ill, and so there's a tragedy built into it. All these flights of fancy. It's like a waking dream. It's a daydream of a movie, and you know, it's kind of lovely for that, but it's also almost too much. You almost feel like you're pinned to the wall and having weird stuff thrown at you, like, you know, like somebody who's been watching CBeebies for a million years, combined with sort of the most imaginative person on the planet. And it's almost too much imagination, if that's such a thing. It's based on a French novel, Froth and the Daydream by Boris Vian. A lot of the quirk comes straight from there. The two kind of combine nicely, the two voices, but there's just a bit too much going on. We gave it 3 stars.
3 stars. It is a recommendation. So, visual feast.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Alright, also out this week is The Nut Job, which is an animated film about squirrels, and the low budget British horror film Blackwood. We gave both those films 2 stars, and that's it for this week's Emperor podcast. If you like listening to us, and we hope you do, otherwise why are you here? You've just been weird. Do go on iTunes and give us a lovely review, leave us some lovely comments, and do give us a nice review, a nice star rating. 5 stars, we hear, is very good.
And obviously buy the magazine, and also please do visit our sponsor's website, squarespace.com.
Squarespace,
and don't forget the code EMPIRE25, which will give you 10% off your new website, which is going to look really slick and great and cool.
What a lovely website. What a lovely, lovely website. Right, enough shilling. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Simon Pegg, who's here to talk about his new film, Hector and the Search for Happiness, and Richard Iowati, who will be talking about the DVD release of The Double, and of course, much, much more besides. Until then, it's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from me. I'm off to celebrate National Orgasm Day in my own inimitable way.